It's good to be here. I'm actually a little nervous because this is the first time I've ever preached in shorts. But I heard that that was a dress code for preaching here. So I thought, since it's a nice day, I'll try it. Even though it feels a little naked, but it's also kind of ironic. Rob told me that most of the men would be gone today, and so I thought it kind of ironic that I wrote a men's book and now I'm preaching here when the men are gone. But it's really a men's book for men who don't read men's books by an author who didn't. I don't have a men's ministry or any of this stuff. I just happen to be a man, and I was struggling with that whole idea in my middle years. But what does that mean for my Christian life? But we won't talk about that today. In fact, I have chosen to preach out of the book of Ruth today, the only book with a female name on it. And so we're going to look at the book of Ruth. Rob told me that he's been looking at the book of Ecclesiastes lately, and I didn't want to steal his thunder or contradict him in any way. So he said, "Well, you can kind of do something on Ecclesiastes if you like, and give him another perspective." But I decided rather I'd look at something practical, because I think the book of Ecclesiastes, to me at least, is a practical book about kind of everyday living. Even though it's written by a guy with 900 wives and all that sort of thing, like, how can that be practical for my everyday life when I don't think that I should have that many? Anyway, Ruth is a very practical, kind of everyday book, and I think it will have some wisdom for us, just as the book of Ecclesiastes has some wisdom for us. Some people called me a dreamer when I was younger, and perhaps I was a dreamer and maybe still am. I've had many dreams. What are your dreams? In junior high, I had a dream of becoming a star. I wanted to be either a star rock and roll singer, so the rock and roll worship this morning was kind of good, or I wanted to be a star football player. As you can tell, the latter dream has kind of faded by now. I'm 5'8", 160 pounds. Not exactly football material. But I was 5'8", 140 when I was in grade 8, so then it was realistic. And you don't want to hear me sing. I might be able to do the, what's that music called now, where you just screamo. I might be able to do. Might be able to do that. But even though I dreamt of being a star, my life has turned out quite ordinary. I graduated from high school, went to Bible college and university, fell in love with an ordinary girl, got married at age 24, which in 1985 was exactly the median age to get married. I've had a few different jobs. I've been unemployed a few times. Today I teach at a college, I get a pretty ordinary salary, I live in an ordinary house in an ordinary city of Abbotsford. We had four children, which is two above the average ordinary, but we have no pets, and only one car, which are below the average, so again, I finished pretty much. I have done a couple of spectacular things. I did finish a half marathon once in 2 hours. I figure that's fairly spectacular. I know, I think the world record is probably 1 hour, I think. I got a bit of time to go there. And it was a few years ago. And I did win a poetry contest once. I got a case of pop. For this poetry contest. It was from this radio station in Winnipeg at the time. Anyway, but pretty much I've lived an ordinary life. And most of you probably are also living a fairly ordinary life. But this doesn't mean that you're banished to some boring, banal existence. Can ordinary life be meaningful? Every morning the alarm sounds, you get dressed, brush your teeth, scarf down some cereal, it's off to school or work, interrupted by coffee breaks, or my son has nut break at his school. Because it's supposed to be called nutrition break, but they call it nut break for short. And then you have lunch hour, and you come home and have supper. You watch some TV or go to a soccer practice or music lesson or a church meeting or do some errands, and you go to bed and you do it all over again. How can ordinary life be meaningful? Now, the Bible contains some pretty exciting stories of daring acts, heroism, rapes and revenge, miracles and mountaintops. But the story this morning is a very ordinary story. By the way, it's nice to recognize a few familiar faces from college days as I'm looking out over ordinary faces. But spectacular people. The story this morning is a very ordinary story, but ordinary things. It's a story of Ruth. Let's begin with chapter 1, and I won't read the whole book this morning. I'll just read a few verses here and there. It begins like this. By the way, the book of Ruth is between the book of Judges and 1 Samuel in your Bibles. It's on page 234 in my Bible. It will probably take you a while to find it, unless you're much sharper than I am. I used to know all the books of the Bible in order, but some of those minor prophets I always get mixed up. But Ruth is between Judges and 1 Samuel. It begins like this. In the days when the judges ruled, there was famine in the land, and a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and two sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. The man's name was Elimelech, his wife's name was Naomi, and the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem, Judah, and they went to Moab and lived there. Now, Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. They married Moabite women, one named Orpah and the other Ruth. After they had lived there about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion also died, and Naomi was left without her two sons and her husband. In the days when the judges ruled is the opening. And that little phrase tells us a lot about this story. Because notice the book of Judges is just before the book of Ruth. In the days when the judges ruled, what were those days like? Two phrases are repeated over and over in the book of Judges. Again, they did evil in the eyes of the Lord, is one of them that is repeated over and over in the book of Judges. Again, they did evil in the eyes of the Lord. Then a judge would come and rescue them, and then they would have good days, and then they would do, and then again they would do evil, and then somebody else would have to come rescue, and it was a vicious cycle. And a second phrase that is repeated over and over and actually ends the book is, in those days, they had no king, everyone did as they saw fit. If you look at verse 25 in the last chapter of Judges, you'll see that line, and it's a few other times in the book. And I'm thinking, sounds like everyday life in the 21st century. Again, they did evil in the eyes of the Lord. In those days, they had no king. Everybody did as they saw fit. Everybody for themselves. Some things never change. So maybe this story is also a story for our time. A second phrase that we should note in this opening phrase is, there was famine in the land. Times were not only bad spiritually with all the evil going on and everybody doing their own thing, and politically there is no king, there's no stability, but also economically. How bad was it? It was so bad that a family moved to another country. In fact, this family moved to an enemy country in order to survive. Moab was the enemy of the Israelite family, and they moved there just to survive. That's how bad the famine was. How bad was the famine? It was so bad, they named their kids Mahlon and Chilion. And if your Bible has little footnotes, Do you know what they named their children? Sickly and puny. You know times are bad when you name your children sickly and puny. But that's literally what their names meant. And they, of course, died at an early age because the famine was so bad. So aging mom is left with her two foreign daughters-in-law. Tragedy. A broken family, poverty, welfare, refugees. Mom's name is Naomi, but she says later on in chapter 1, she says, "Don't call me Naomi anymore, call me bitter, because I am bitter." Names, of course, in their culture were very significant. They said something about them, and so she didn't want to be called Naomi anymore. "Just call me bitter, because life has been bitter to me." And so starts our story. No great plot. No great conflict, just some ordinary problems about food, finances, and family. We too experience issues of food. Perhaps you're on a special diet because of your health, or maybe some of you want to be. We all have financial issues, bills to pay, shopping to do. It seems there's never enough to make ends meet, or maybe other people have the opposite problem. You don't know what to do with your money, come see me. Columbia can always use more donations. And we all have problems with family, sibling rivalries, aging parents or grandparents, marital tensions, new friends that we're getting adjusted to. This is ordinary life, food, finances, and family. That's what our ordinary lives are all about. Does God care about people with ordinary lives? Does God care about food, finances, and family? Chapter 2. I'll read the first 13 verses. Now Naomi had a relative on her husband's side from the clan of Elimelech, a man of standing whose name was Boaz. And Ruth, the Moabitess, said to Naomi, "Let me go to the fields and pick up the leftover grain behind anyone in whose eyes I find favor." Naomi said to her, "Go ahead, my daughter." So she went out and began to glean in the fields behind the harvesters. As it turned out, she found herself working in a field belonging to Boaz, who is from the clan of Elimelech. Just then, Boaz arrived from Bethlehem and greeted the harvesters. "The Lord be with you." "The Lord bless you," they called back. Boaz asked the foreman of his harvesters, "Whose young woman is that?" The foreman replied, "She is the Moabitess who came back from Moab with Naomi." She said, please let me glean and gather among the sheaves behind the harvesters." She went into the field and has worked steadily from the morning till now, except for a short rest in the shelter. So Boaz said to Ruth, "My daughter, listen to me. Don't go and glean in another field, and don't go away from here. Stay here with my servant girls. Watch the field where the men are harvesting and follow along after the girls. I have told the men not to touch you. And whenever you are thirsty, go and get a drink from the water jars the men have filled." At this, she bowed down with her face to the ground. She exclaimed, "Why have I found such favor in your eyes that you notice me, a foreigner?" Boaz replied, "I've been told all about what you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, and how you left your father and mother and your homeland and came to live with a people you did not know before. May the Lord repay you for what you have done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." "May I continue to find favor in your eyes, my Lord," she said. You have given me comfort and have spoken kindly to your servant, though I do not have the standing of one of your servant girls." And the story continues. They have communion. He offers her some wine and some bread on the field, and we'll continue the story a bit later. And you're thinking, oh my, this is so exciting. Here's my contemporary paraphrase of this story. Somebody goes to the grocery store, meets the owner, and they find out they might be related. I'm on the edge of my seat. This could have happened in Chilliwack or any other Menno town. But there's a few things to notice about this very ordinary story. It begins in chapter 1. The author lets us in on a secret in verse 1. And the secret is the characters in the story. The characters in the story don't realize it in verse 1. But the author lets us in on the secret. The characters only realize its importance later. The secret is Boaz and who he is. First of all, the fact that he's a relative. And in that culture, family ties were very, very significant. God worked through families. Family meant protection. Family meant trust. Boaz was also, it says, a man of standing. He was a man of means. He was fairly wealthy. He had money, influence. He had moral integrity in the community. That's very significant, as we will find out in the story later. And then in verse 3, notice a little phrase. So she went out and began to glean in the fields behind the harvesters. As it turned out, she found herself working in the field that belonged to Boaz. It just so happened that she was working in Boaz's field. It seemed like pure coincidence to Ruth and Boaz. But when Naomi looks back on it later on in the story, she sees the hand of God in this coincidence. It just so happened. I call this kind of thing a divine coincidence. I'll tell you a bit about my own story. It just so happened that I was the Bible study coordinator for InterVarsity Christian Fellowship on the campus of Brandon University. And it just so happened that this young woman from a number of hours away had also registered for Brandon University and was also a Christian and so attended InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. And it just so happened that I really liked football, and I was walking around at the barbecue looking for somebody to play football with me. And it just so happened that this girl was a kind of a jock, and she is willing to do anything active. And so we started tossing the football around, and it just so happened that I recognized that she was wearing a shirt of a camp ministry that I recognized. And so, you know how you make connections. And it just so happened that we talked later, and sometime later it just so happened that we got married. Was that just a mere coincidence that we met at this barbecue? It was a divine coincidence. As we look back in retrospect, we look at it differently. Yeah, they were ordinary circumstances. You go to a barbecue, you hang out, and you play football, and it's ordinary stuff. There's nothing spectacular about it. But you look at it from the other side, from the other perspective. Hey, God, we say God led us together through these ordinary circumstances, just as it turned out. A third thing to notice is Ruth's response. In verses 10 to 13, she bowed down. Ruth realized that she was at the mercy of others, that she was dependent. Part of it was women were not even considered people in those days, and were at the subservient mercy of the males in the culture. But she had a strong sense of her dependency. According to God's law, she had a right to gather grain. But in humility, she didn't even demand that right. It seems to me that God often meets us when we are at the end of our rope, when we are forced to admit that we're dependent on God. Now, I know we're always dependent on God. Like, that's just good theology. We're always dependent on God, but we aren't always aware of how dependent we are. And Ruth was very aware of her dependence on God. It's not that God doesn't help us at other times. but we just don't notice it. A fourth thing to notice, in verses 14 to 23, which we didn't read, Boaz provides her with an extra measure of food to take home. God's provision comes through the actions of others. God's people are God's hands. God uses people to care for people. Boaz is God's hands to Ruth, and Ruth later becomes God's hands that provides for Boaz's loneliness. It's like the fable that I heard years ago about the two brothers, one who got married and had a large family, and the other one who remained single. They both had a part of their father's milling business, and the son with the large family thought, you know, my brother is all alone. He must feel like everybody's abandoned him. I'm going to, at night, sneak over and bring him an extra sack of flour from my mill so that he has this sense that there's other people who are looking out for him. And it was interesting that the single son was thinking of his brother with a large family and says, you know, it's just me and myself, but my brother has a large family to feed. I think I should sneak over at night and bring him a bag of flour so that he can feed his large family. And after a number of nights of this and both of them responding, say, wow, God has blessed us. You know, we have enough food to feed our family. And the single son says, yeah, God has blessed me. I'm not alone in the world. Somebody's looking out for me. And one night the two of them actually met and found out that it was the other brother who had been supplying their need. And God had blessed them through the other brother. God's provision comes through the actions of others. Let's continue the story of Ruth. The story of Ruth takes place in the midst of ordinary tough times, and they see God's provision through ordinary ways, through other people, as they depend on God. But chapters 3 and 4, we have ordinary good times. I'm not going to read the story in chapter 3, but I'll give you a title for it, Romance at the Threshing Floor. Another edge of your seat, drooling with anticipation, drama. Maybe for those who enjoy chick flicks, this could be made into one of those romantic comedies. Well, actually, it's probably more like a Kleenex box romance. I'm not going to go into all the strange dating practices here this morning. We could be here all day. We don't need to explore those strange dating practices, as intriguing as they are. But basically what happens here is that two people fall in love and get married. That's the bottom line. I have no complaints about that. Life is good, and Ruth's life turns out good. But nothing out of the ordinary. First comes love, then comes marriage, then comes Ruth with a baby carriage. That's a basic, ordinary story for a lot of people. And then, in chapter 4, the book ends with that most tension-cracking climax. A genealogy. Unless you're our librarian at the college, Richard Thiessen, who actually does enjoy genealogies, most of us kind of, when we see those parts in the Bible, we usually kind of skip over them because they're boring and we don't know how to pronounce the names. But that's how this book ends. It's an ordinary book that ends in a very ordinary, kind of boring way. And we think of these genealogies as irrelevant, but they're very important. There's a reason why these genealogies are there. They remind us of our connectedness with other people and with other generations. They give us a sense of being part of something that's bigger than we are. They help us to know who we are, where our roots are, how our ordinary lives fit into the bigger picture of humanity. And so also this genealogy. I'll paraphrase it for you. Ruth, a foreign woman, an outsider, coming to Bethlehem with nothing, was accepted as part of God's people, marries Boaz, becomes the mother of Obed. Obed becomes the father of Jesse, who becomes the father of David. David, the greatest king of God's nation, the royal line through which the promised Messiah would come. We know that part of the story, even though the author at this time didn't know that yet. David was enough to make it significant. Jesus, son of David, grandson of Ruth, son of God, Savior of all nations. Wow. And when Jesus was born, of David's line, of Ruth's line, in that same Bethlehem where Ruth came, he was born into an ordinary family. A young girl and her carpenter fiancé. And they too, like Ruth, by their willing and humble obedience to their God who is gracious, were instruments of God's providential purposes in the world. Maybe you've heard that story before. And this little ordinary story of Ruth is part of that much bigger story of salvation for the entire cosmos. It's amazing. And so our faith, our ordinary lives, our food, our finances, our family, our decisions too, are part of God's providential care. We're part of the same genealogy as Ruth and David. Our ordinary lives meet with theirs. And this is when ordinary life becomes extraordinary. The God who called Ruth also calls us. Not necessarily to become rock stars. There may be one here. But to be ordinary. May we, like Ruth did, pledge our willing and loving obedience to God. Let's celebrate being ordinary. Let's be open to God's extraordinary work in our ordinary lives. God does miraculous things through ordinary people and ordinary circumstances. It might be through a geographical move. It might be through scarcity of food or finances. It might be through the tragic loss of someone we love. It might be through our marriage. It might be through our singleness. It might be through our children. Who knows who we might meet at the grocery store tomorrow? Who knows what might happen with our ordinary lives as we pledge them in humble obedience to God?